Welcome back to this third and final portion of today's seminar called Supervision. In this last portion of the seminar, we're going to look at some case examples and ways of just putting everything together that we've learned at this seminar today. So let's kind of pull together the different sort of things that we've talked about throughout this seminar and see how we might be able to build on that. Let's read our first example and think about how we can conceptualize these cases and supervision. A supervisee comes to you as his supervisor, unsure of what to do. "I feel like this case is way beyond me. I have no idea how to help these people," the supervisee comments. He describes a sense of stuckness and wanting specific direction from you about what to do next to help solve and fix the client's presenting concerns. So as I hear this, my first gut reaction is one of, wow, this sounds a lot like the reactions of supervisees that may have a relatively beginning level of experience. They may feel really unsure of themselves. This person might need a lot of Rogers process variables to be evidenced by the supervisor. So the first step I would take if I was a supervisor would be affirming their ability to reach out to me and their willingness to do so. Just even to have that awareness of, I feel the case is way beyond me. I also would probably highlight the things that we talked about earlier in those slides about what are some ways that supervisees can broach some questions when they need help or assistance. So again, making sure that the supervisee knows that I am approachable, I am available, and that I'm backing them up for their desire to want to do better and to be as successful as possible in their interaction with clients. One of the things that's interesting to me is when supervisees can be stuck, they may say the case is way beyond me or I have no idea how to help these people. But sometimes if we engage a supervisee in conversation, there are things they are doing that are very beneficial. And so continuing to help discuss how the assessment process has gone, continuing to explore the treatment goal formation and how concrete and behavioral it is, continuing to even look at how maybe some of the stuckness could even be a beneficial thing. I talk in depth about that in my seminar about resistance. So if you're interested in learning more about that, you might want to, you know, look at that seminar. That sometimes the resistance that we might feel as a clinician as a bad thing actually can be a tool to what the client might be dealing with outside of sessions. So it may not be a bad thing. The other thing that jumps out to me about this example is that at the end of this blurb, it says that the supervisee is wanting specific direction and wanting help in solving and fixing the client's presenting concerns. So while the Rogers process variables are important as a starting point for working with this person who's at an earlier developmental level, in the long run, what the supervisee is asking for is some direction, some teaching approach. So we may actually want to do some role plays. It might be a good example or a good time for me as a supervisor to come and sit in on the session to observe or to actually get more details in terms of how we can be helpful. But I probably will want to help do some reframing in the supervision session with the supervisee about their idea of, quote, solving and fixing the client's presenting concerns. What concerns me about that is it sounds a lot like the assumption that I, quote unquote, should be the expert in the situation. And one of the things we want to highlight with a supervisee is, again, that many times we're a facilitator. We're in a joint therapeutic venture with a client while we're providing some activities, some homework, some clinical direction. We're also journeying with them, and it's not that we necessarily are coming in from without with this perfection and expertise. So maybe helping lighten some of that burden and undue responsibility that the supervisee has. Let's look at our second example here. A supervisee tells you he is ready to begin, or she is ready to begin seeing clients on her own. She has learned a lot from sitting in on sessions with you and observing sessions. She feels about ready to try it out now on her own. You've not witnessed her with clients directly, but are aware that she has given some good insight into your case discussions with your clients already. How do you handle her request to start seeing her own caseload of clients? Well, again, first of all, I always try to start out with some type of affirmation. So the point that she's willing to sort of take a risk and possibly move towards an increasing developing level of autonomy, I think is something we want to affirm. One of the areas that is important to have discussion about is what level of autonomy is appropriate. So while she may have given good comments about sitting in on my work with a client, it might be useful to even take a next step transition to where, even if she's starting to see her own clients, maybe I'm sitting in on some of the sessions. Or maybe there's some audio or videotape to where we're making sure that there is that comfort level. I would probably want to know what some of the concrete behavioral evidence is that she has, that she's like, yeah, I'm ready for this. But again, also making sure that even with an increased level of autonomy, that there still is the realization and understanding that there's liability and involvement that the supervisor has to have on the cases as well. Let's take a look at a third example here. A supervisee is eager to get a client to, quote, quickly get past his trauma, unquote, since he sees the impact the client's stress is having on him. In an attempt to get through the counseling, the supervisee explains that he fostered the client's cathartic reactions since he read that catharsis is good. Since you've received a call from the client that his flashbacks and trauma symptoms have really escalated to where the client put in an emergency call to his psychiatrist. The client has clearly been escalating since the session with the supervisee. How should this be handled? Well, first of all, it sounds like the supervisee is wanting to do what they think is clinically appropriate. If they have been reading about catharsis, it seems like maybe they're trying to adopt a certain point of view without full understanding of the context in which that's most helpful. One of the things that we definitely would want to have a discussion about in this such example is how to make sure a client leaves the session de-escalated, to make sure the level of impact or the interventions we're using are at an appropriate level to what the client can handle and what is rational and reasonable. If this client is having to meet with a psychiatrist and going through emergencies, I would definitely want to talk with a supervisee about some immediate follow-up with the client. Whether it's a supervisee himself calling and checking in and learning how to de-escalate, or maybe having a session with the supervisor and the supervisee together with the client, or some consultation about if a higher level of care is needed, or what should happen. Trauma counseling specifically requires a special level of care and understanding to where I would want to make sure the supervisee has a training and a competency in terms of trauma-informed care. So I do think that follow-up, even previous to the next scheduled session, would be definitely warranted. Let's look at a next example here. In a team meeting at your mental health center, it becomes clear that a supervisee forgot to inquire and document about some potential risk factors with an agitated client after a session days ago. The supervisee wants to do the right things and seems to fear negative evaluation, yet he's fearful that maybe there were steps in risk management that were avoided. The supervisee thinks possibly more should have been done since the client has a history of impulsivity and behavioral acting out. How would you handle this with a supervisee? Well, as we remember from earlier points in today's seminar, because supervisees feel evaluated, sometimes when it comes to risk issues, they may underreport, or if they feel like they might have made a mistake or have second thoughts about how they've done something, later they might be like, oh my, I wish I had done A, B, and C. So first I would affirm their desire to do the right thing by even bringing this up when they had a second thought. I would definitely affirm that sometimes when we have that gut reaction about, maybe I should go back and revisit this. Maybe I need to document more. Maybe I need to consider more. Maybe I need to check in again with the client on that. That sometimes that gut reaction is useful. And that one of the best things that this supervisee did was to check with the supervisor or another colleague about what the standard of practice would be. I like that it came to the supervisee's mind to think about the historical narrative of a client, the history of impulsivity and behavior acting out. And so while maybe certain thoughts or certain level of agitation with the client might not always mean there's a risk, that because they remembered how a client's dynamics played out in other situations, that was a red flag for them. So it's good that the supervisee is willing to revisit this. And that might be, you know, a red flag to make sure that there's a follow-up phone call or a check-in even before the next scheduled appointment. Let's look at a next example here. You are in a mixed group of supervisees with varying developmental and experiential levels. You want to set the group up so it is beneficial for all supervisees, regardless of developmental level. So the less experienced ones have an opportunity to learn and try new skills without fear, and the more experienced ones benefit from an opportunity for consultation. Is there a way to effectively manage the mixed group? This just reminds me of some of the general foundational things that we know when it comes to group dynamics, whether it's group therapy or group supervision in general. I actually think it's very beneficial, especially when we're talking about supervision, for supervisees at varying levels of development to really be in there together. One, because the group dynamics highlight the commonalities that regardless of developmental level, they all can have. That whether someone's seasoned or been in the mental health field practicing for years, that there's still going to be some discomfort, just like there is for a beginning supervisee. And there may be different ways of brainstorming or different ways of acting out applications with regards to clients. So actually, this could be an ideal dynamic. Sometimes even the more experienced or the higher developmental level supervisees can benefit from the newness, the creativity, the wonder, the difference of perspective of the less experienced developmental supervisees. Just like the earlier developmental supervisees can benefit from some of the depth of the ways, like if you remember the synergistic model of supervision, where they looked at the increasingly in-depth applications of techniques and things, they could benefit from that and from hearing that from more advanced supervisees. Let's take a look at the next example here. Your supervisee has been excellent at applying Rogers' clinical process variables and basic clinical professional skills with clients. However, she struggles in learning what is the best evidence-based techniques for different disorders and presenting concerns. How could this be addressed? I probably would want to schedule almost like a didactic teaching learning session. Because again, just because supervisees in graduate school or in a certain venue that they're working may have heard of various techniques does not mean that they know really how and when to apply them. So it might be good to have a little mini seminar with the department or a little one-on-one discussion even with the supervisee about what are each of the common disorders in the DSM and what are some of the appropriate types of evidence-based techniques for them. And then maybe just talking through some awareness of the comfort level of the supervisee with those different types of interventions. I remember when I worked at a community mental health center years ago, the director had asked me to do for the staff just a basic overview of some of the most common techniques so that people were aware of what type of techniques go with what types of disorders. That can be a challenge. So that's something that may be useful in terms of developing competencies. In our next example, we have a supervisee who is focused on providing professionally, clinically sound services to clients. However, after back-to-back clients, you realize there's a number of undone progress notes in the charts. What is your approach to this? Now, I included this example because a lot of times when we talk about examples of supervision, we tend to think about what happens in the actual clinical sessions in terms of the exchanges between clients and clinicians. But again, it is no less important for us to be working with supervisees on issues like charting and record keeping. Actually, in my experience with supervisees through the years, sometimes the paperwork, sometimes the insurance stuff, or the marketing and private practice, or the other related tasks have actually been what has tended to bog down the clinician rather than the actual clinical interactions. I remember with one supervisee, for a while, we scheduled Friday nights where we sat at the office and did some note-taking together and documentation, and I worked on my chart, she worked on hers, and we kind of, I was able to role model how to somewhat concisely, but with specific evidence, document when documenting isn't realistically probably the most thrilling aspect of what we do. Let's look at another example. Since your supervisee is in the earlier developmental stages, he seems to have a number of insecurities about his counseling clients in between weekly scheduled supervision sessions. How should the two of you deal with the questions and issues beyond the scheduled supervision sessions? Well, I think this is where that initial supervision agreement is very important. It's really good, just like an informed consent or a policies and procedures agreement when a new client comes in. Supervisees and supervisors can benefit from that initial supervision agreement. It can spell out what should happen when concerns arise beyond the scheduled supervision hours, because inevitably that will happen. How should the supervisor be reached? What if something, for example, becomes a crisis or something that needs intervention but the supervisor can't be reached? Is there a backup person? Is there another person, for example, at the agency who might be at a farther along developmental level or might be independently licensed or someone they can check in with? So these are things that should basically be discussed before the supervision arrangement is even implemented so that they know what they're doing from there. Let's look at the next example here. A client of your supervisee asks for a summary paragraph summarizing your session to be typed and submitted on the client's behalf. You, the supervisor, are out of the office at the time in a meeting elsewhere. The supervisee's client insists he cannot wait. How should the supervisee respond? This is a foundation, again, that should be established early on. Keep in mind, again, the liabilities and the importance of making sure that the supervisor signs off on things or at least reviews them. So it still should be something that the supervisee is able to highlight that they need to have the signature or the approval of the supervisor. So one of the things is, you know, again, going back to that discussion of what is an appropriate level of autonomy. Now, are we talking about a form letter saying that, yes, so-and-so has attended a session on this date so that they have a work excuse? Or are we talking about a more detailed summary of what's happened in the session, something that really will need to be reviewed in depth with the supervisor? These are things that need to be reviewed and shared, and really where there needs to be informed consent at the earlier stages of supervision and with the client and the supervisee. How about this next example? You receive a phone call from one of your supervisee's clients who is unhappy with the way sessions are going. What steps do you take with the client? What about with the supervisee? Now, keep in mind, just because a client might be unhappy with the way sessions are going doesn't necessarily mean that the supervisee, the supervisor, the agency, or the client is, quote, at fault. We all know, after having been in the field a while, that we're looking at goodness of fit. And there's not always an ideal fit between a given clinician and a client. So I would want to first hear what it is that this client's unhappy about. I have had times where a parent of a child or someone will call me and say they feel like therapy, for example, isn't moving along fast enough with the supervisee, that they're wanting quicker answers, especially when anxiety is the issue. So what I'd probably do is get some understanding of the concrete expectations that the client's looking for and what their understanding of the therapeutic process should involve. And then speak with the supervisee about how we might want to handle it. I remember in one situation years ago, I ended up meeting with the supervisee's client on my own and actually ended up overlapping or doing much of the same work that the supervisee did. But there were other dynamics simultaneously going on as well in the client's life that increased their readiness to hear and to implement things. So again, we want to make sure the supervisee understands that it's not necessarily a personal issue against them. It may be just a readiness issue or a style issue. There's a lot of reasons why someone might do better with one clinician than another. Let's look at the next example here. Your supervisor's style is very reflective and involves active listening. While this helps build your confidence to some degree, you still end up feeling lost as how to do treatment planning and implementation with some of your most resistant clients. How do you find the help you need as a supervisee? I remember exactly being in this boat when I started my graduate internship. Again, I had someone who is more of a reflective type of supervision style. It was very warm and caring. I really felt believed in. I felt affirmed. And so that did help me in the earlier stages of insecurity. But on the other hand, there were times, like I had a few cases that were court involved because the mothers and fathers were divorced, and that, you know, gave me a lot of anxiety of, wow, you know, they're wanting me to go to court and I don't even have my master's yet. I'm in an internship type of thing. That was very nerve-wracking. And so really the thing that was helpful to me was being able to develop a voice with my supervisor about the concrete teaching didactic moments that I needed. And also to involve a number of the staff that were more experienced than I was at that time in terms of getting their feedback about how they would approach things. So let's look at the next example here. As a supervisor, one of the tasks of supervision involves how to know how to assign tasks to supervisees based on a reasonable level of autonomy. How can you determine what that would be for each of your supervisees? Well, first of all, I think even when we're starting to engage in any level of supervision, we need to do some type of basic interview like we would for any of our employees. So basically to understand what their job experiences in the mental health field have been, what they're comfortable with, what they're not comfortable with. And not just at that early stage, but throughout, kind of evaluating and reevaluating. And then to kind of keep revisiting that off and on. The more different ways that we measure and evaluate things, the better as well. So that can give us a better picture of how things go. We can have a supervisee interacting in a staff meeting about case conceptualizations with other therapists. We can have them in our individual supervision or in a group supervision setting. And then when we put all these experiences together, we get a more whole picture of what's going on. A few more examples here, and then we'll be wrapping up. A supervisee is clearly overwhelmed juggling school requirements, licensure requirements, and personal life. She appears rushed, stressed out, tired, and is having difficulty focusing. How do you handle this? So one of the things I think we really need to highlight in the supervision dynamic is that it's not just what happens clinically, but it's also the work-life balance piece. Are the personal and professional identity and development goals, are they reasonable? Are they rational? A lot of times we'll have supervisees who are juggling school. They're taking several graduate classes. They might have a family life or personal things going on in their life. And while we're not supposed to be their clinical counselor, it is useful for them to be able to approach us on a general level when they have this going on about how to balance things, and highlighting with them that there's no shame in having to modify or reevaluate how time's being spent on different things. Let's take a look at our final example here. It becomes apparent after a few weeks into supervision that it's just not a good match between you and the supervisee. It's challenging for either of you to give and receive feedback. Communications appear strained. Your personalities aren't meshing well. However, your student is in the middle of a semester. How do the two of you deal with this ethically and professionally? So what comes to mind is we have a few different layers simultaneously here. We have the requirements of the supervisee for school or for the board and what they're at. There's the needs at your practice or agency where the client's care is of utmost concern and making sure to minimize the level of disruption to that. I think one of the things that this highlights is the importance of, on a regular basis, being able to create an atmosphere in supervision where things can be broached, not just when it reaches that serious level where it's like, oh gosh, what are we going to do from here? But that it can be broached as both the supervisee and the supervisor realize that the match isn't good, that it can be reevaluated, that transitions can be talked about. You know, we need to create an environment of awareness, of self-evaluation, of willingness to kind of head things off of the past and realize that, yeah, we need to consider different options when that's necessary. But continuity of care is really important because that, again, can be a challenge for a client when they've started working with someone. And so making sure that there is continuous care, whether it's with another clinician, whether it's a referral, whether it's the supervisor becomes more involved, you know, that there is, that we're not compromising on those ethical things, the values that we talked about, doing good, avoiding harm, making sure that we're meeting the client where he or she's at. Well, I appreciate you joining me for this 6CEU seminar entitled Supervision. And you'll want to make sure after you finish listening to this and the audios that you go to the mandatory true-false test also on the website at www.rolpc.org. Again, that's www.rolpc.org on the home study test page. You can just do that right on the website and it will send your results date and time stamp to me. That way I'll be able to send you as an email attachment the certificate of completion for this study. Remember that in order to get the CEU hours for that, you should have registered and paid in advance for this. So just making sure that that's all up to date. And so within a day or two, generally, we try to send as an email attachment that printable certificate for your records that will match up with the date that the home study test is received. If you do have any questions, feel free to contact us here at River of Life Professional Counseling. Our phone number is 614-353-4157, and we wish you well in your clinical endeavors.